I am now recording.
All right, rolling.
Hey, Martin.
Hey, Christina.
I just have a really fast and easy and quick and like really non-invasive question for you.
I totally believe you.
How productive would you say the parietal cells located in the corpus of your stomach are? Have you ever measured their productivity?
I have never measured the productivity of the parietal cells in the corpus of my stomach. And now I feel bad about that. I should ask next time to the doctor if they can do that test.
As a proxy, have you ever measured the productivity of your salivary gland?
I have not. Although, coincidentally, I did just do a paper at NCA, at National Communication Association, about saliva. You might think I'm joking, but
no, I know you're not joking, which is why I'm laughing. But I do find it to be quite suspicious that you gave a whole paper about saliva and yet you have never measured the productivity of your salivary gland.
This is true. This was a major oversight. I'm surprised that nobody stormed out of my session when they discovered that was true.
You might not have noticed, but I did hear on Twitter that several people stormed out.
I don't blame them.
Do you want to record season two? Should we record season two?
Oh, this had nothing to do with season two? This was actually just for your curiosity?
Completely unrelated to season two.
Oh, okay. Well, that's very weird, and now I feel violated, but... Okay, let's go. Let's record season two of this weird show.
Season two.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to season two of They Did What to What? A show about science, where we look at studies that inform how people think about how people think. It's like a virtual journal club, except it's weird old stuff.
Weird old timey stuff.
Yeah.
We got pretty recent at the end of season one, so I wanted to make sure that we pushed the timeline back for season two.
But by pretty recent, you mean 30 years ago, right?
Yes, 30 years ago.
It's pretty recent.
Can you guess, based on that wonderful introduction, what we're talking about today?
The most classic study I know about saliva would have to be... and I'll say that I am not, in fact, a saliva expert. Although I do, I do know someone, a friend of mine had, his dad was, a swallowologist.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Or he called himself a swallowologist, but he was a communication disorders scholar who specialized in swallowing. He would probably know about more classic saliva studies, but me personally... All I know about is Pavlov.
Hey, it's Pavlov.
Yeah. I mean, also, I kind of looked at the schedule, so I kind of knew that. Ugh. But I mean, also, yeah. Name another classic saliva study. I dare you.
I don't think that I could.
No.
I don't know of any others.
Yeah. All right. So Pavlov.
What do you remember? What do you remember from your training about Pavlov?
Well, I guess it's weird to call it Pavlov. That's like calling Frankenstein, like Frankenstein was the doctor.
You are stealing the metaphor that I was going to make at the very end of this episode. I can't even believe you are doing this to me. Season two, opening season two, stealing my metaphor. Go on. Tell the listeners. Why it's like...
It just occurred to me that I had been saying Pavlov. It's like, it has nothing to do with him. He wasn't studying his own salivation. He was studying the salivation of dogs, if I remember.
Or was he?
Well, so this is important, though, because this is what's weird about this one, is I feel like, and we'll probably find out that I'm wrong, but I feel like this is one where I might actually know like what the study was about. Because it's such a basic isn't the right word, but it's such like a kind of rudimentary or foundational study. Because like for example, like the Dunning-Kruger effect, like we know what the effect is, but I had absolutely no idea how they went about testing it. It's just mm-hmm. like, I never would have guessed that they had done all that nonsense they did. Like, I had no idea famous comedian Al Franken would be part of it.
Yeah. Research methods, ranking jokes.
Like,
how funny is that joke?
I never would have guessed that was part of the Dunning-Kruger effect. However, with Pavlov, like, my understanding is that what he was testing was how much dogs salivate when he rings a bell. And so, like, I think that was probably his method. I think his method was testing how much dogs salivate. I think.
I can't wait until we get to that slide so I can say, you rube, you absolute rube. Ha ha ha. I feel like it's kind of a little bit evil to have this part of the podcast because I have all the answers, right? And you don't have the answers.
Well, that is the...
So I'm sitting here.
That is the saying, premise, right?
You silly, silly person. How could you think that there was a bell? How could you think that?
I'm a stand-in for our moderately informed listener who's like, I've heard of this. I know what this is about. And then you laugh at me rather than them. Oh. So, because we don't want to alienate the listener, right?
That's true.
I'm a stand-in for them, so they can also laugh at me. We build some kind of, there's probably a theory about like how this builds some sense of like community, parasocial mm-hmm. community between you and the listener. Mm-hmm. Probably they're coming to hate me in this weird kind of way where I represent all of their own insecurities. If they see me in public, they're going to throw things at me.
I don't think they would hate you. I think they would hate me because I'm the person telling them that they're wrong, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, I think maybe they're identifying with you against me, which is the part of themselves that they hate.
Oh my God.
I am becoming their Frankenstein's monster. I am.
Don't you steal my metaphor twice in one introduction. I can't handle that.
See, this is what I'm saying. This is why they hate me. Because here I am ruining your metaphors.
Well, hopefully they forget in the time that it takes to get to the metaphor, actually.
Or I'll try not to mention it again.
Okay, so for the experiment, what are the elements that you remember? What do you think happened?
There was a dog, there was some food, probably meat. I'm going to say it was meat. I remember seeing drawings with a dog with meat in front of it and a bell. These are the elements. Yeah. Again, I think I saw a lot of diagrams, like drawings of the apparatus where the dog is held in place and the meat is put near its mouth. Yeah. These are the elements I remember.
And what was he studying? What was he looking at?
Pavlov was studying, how much the dog drooled. It was attempting to draw a connection between the bell and the drool, trying to condition a response. It was conditioning.
Maybe even Pavlovian conditioning.
It's so weird that Pavlov was studying Pavlovian conditioning. It's so,
what are the odds?
It's so appropriate.
What are the chances?
I was trying to remember what it was called because it's different than operant conditioning, which was what Watson was doing. This is the other kind of conditioning. I can never remember what it's called.
No, it's the same conditioning. This is classical conditioning. Yeah. Skinner did the other kind of conditioning.
Watson was Skinner still doing did classical operant conditioning. That's right.
Yeah. Oh. This is still classical.
All right.
And we can do an episode on Skinner, but he's kind of a shiesty man,
Yeah.
Where he wrote a review of the types of conditioning, and he put his type of conditioning, and he named it conditioning type 1. And then he put Pavlov's type of conditioning as conditioning type 2, even though Pavlov's was described, obviously, decades earlier.
Yeah.
So if you write things, if you write textbooks, if you write reviews, you get to frame the world how you want it to be framed.
This is the second time we've come down kind of hard on textbook writers, I think.
No. On Skinner. We're coming down hard on Skinner.
Did you read his utopian novel?
Not yet, no.
Walden 2?
I'm sure that I will when we eventually do our Skinner episode.
It's weird that he didn't call his Walden Type 1.
Walden 1.
even though it was hundreds of years after the first one.
Yeah, it seems to be his MO for sure. So for Pavlov, I want to put a very clear disclaimer at the top of the episode that I am not an expert in Russian geopolitical history. I don't speak Russian. Pavlov wrote in Russian. I am not familiar with Russian Orthodox religion, all of these different things. They're all important, mm-hmm. and I'm not the expert on them. So if I say something wrong, I'm very sorry. I apologize.
Yep.
It was unintentional, blah, blah, blah. Yep. But we're dealing with Pavlov, who was born in 1849, and there was a different calendar at the time. So Ivan Petrovich Pavlov. Right. Yeah, he was born either on September 14th or the 27th, depending on which goddamn calendar you use. So just pick one. He's either born on the 17th or the 27th, and you will be correct if you say either of those days. He was born in 1849, so totally two centuries removed from us now. Mm-hmm. And he didn't speak English. So one of the huge themes of this episode is nobody knew anything. Nobody knew what he was saying because they didn't speak Russian. I don't believe that he spoke English. I really tried to figure out, did Pavlov speak English? Uh-huh. If you look at my search history, it's just 20 Google searches of variations of, did Pavlov speak English? Could Pavlov speak English? Could Pavlov read English? All of those things. I don't know. I don't think that he did, but I don't know. So Pavlov is initially born into a family of priests. He first trained to be a priest, and then he studied to be a doctor, and then he became the director of research in a laboratory, and then he was appointed professor of pharmacology, and then physiology in St. Petersburg. And St. Petersburg, the city, has gone through three different names.
Yep.
It was first, what was it? It was Stalingrad, and then Leningrad, and then St. Petersburg? Is that true?
It would have been St. Petersburg first, certainly.
It was like Petersgrad?
Petrograd.
Petrograd,
because they wanted to Russify it at some point. St. Petersburg is like a Germanish name or something. I can't remember.
Yeah.
There's something like that. I'm also not an expert in, 19th century Russian geopolitical history, but I kind of remember.
Should we just be done? Should we just stop? We shouldn't be here. We have to stop. So anyway, he started off in religion. Over his lifetime, he grew to hate religion, even though his wife was extremely religious. But have no fear, he had a decades-long affair with his laboratory assistant.
Oh, good, good, good. Okay. I was worried about that.
Yeah, that he was suffering with his wife. No, he had an affair partner, so
yeah,
that's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, good.
And then he moved more and more and more into science and hated religion over the course of his life.
Right. Well, I mean, because he couldn't have an affair with his assistant in the church.
Right. Yeah. He tried and she was like, no.
Yeah. Yeah. So it makes sense why he picked what he picked. Yep.
Oh, I'm glad he's not alive and he can't sue us for slander. He only had one affair partner, Martin, not multiple affair partners. So he died in 1936. He was 86 years old. And in 1949, at the 100-year anniversary of his death, Nature published a news article. So the journal Nature, that's very, very old and is still around and prestigious today, published something marking the 100-year anniversary of his birth. And in that article, they said, only part of Pavlov's work is available to English-speaking readers. It is contained in his Conditioned Reflexes, Oxford Press, 1927, and Lectures on Conditioned Reflexes, International Publishers, 1928, and Conditioned Reflexes and Psychiatry, 1941. So this was published in 1949, and they're citing things within the last couple of decades, starting with 27 of English translations that were available.
Wow.
So Pavlov won the Nobel Prize in 1904. So decades after winning the Nobel Prize, his work wasn't available in English.
Wow.
And he won the Nobel Prize for what, Martin? Do you know this little tidbit? And by little tidbit, I mean Nobel Prize. Yeah.
I mean, I assume it probably had something to do with conditioned reflexes, given that that's what...
It had absolutely nothing to do with conditioned reflexes. So Pavlov was a physiologist first, and he was completely concerned with physiology, and his doctoral thesis work was concerned with the heart and the neuronal signaling of the heart.
Very cool.
And then he went on to study physiology for the rest of his life. And he won the Nobel Prize in 1904 for physiology, the Nobel Prize in medicine.
Right.
He gave his Nobel speech in German.
Ooh.
And it was for the physiology of digestion. So it had absolutely not a single thing to do with conditioned responses.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Or conditioning. Yeah. So my metaphor that was stolen, dastardly stolen from me, was that knowing, like, the first level is knowing that Frankenstein exists, right? And the second level is knowing that Frankenstein is the name of the doctor and not the monster.
Right.
So for Pavlov, the first level is knowing Pavlov exists. And the second level is knowing that he was a physiologist, not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And I feel like that information has sort of permeated the psyche, but apparently not everyone's psyche, because some people are still under the erroneous assumption that he won the Nobel Prize for conditioning, which he did not.
I had absolutely no idea.
So Pavlov's work was not available in English contemporary to his work. And there's a wonderful article or set of translations that came out in February 2023 by Olga Yokoyama. And the introduction of her translations is just absolutely emotionally devastating. Because I read this last. Mm. I read her introduction last.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, quote, "Suffice to say that besides misunderstanding countless words and phrases and omitting hard-to-translate spots and many larger chunks that Gant, the guy who did the translations, mm-hmm. may have found to be repetitive, some small points are arguably not crucial in scientific writing, although I argue otherwise. The text was occasionally, but most critically for a scientific work, misread by the translator in such a way as to produce a meaning that was the opposite of that in the original." So this work by Olga, she said that the person who translated most of Pavlov's work and those translations that were available for 100 years are just wrong.
Got it literally backwards.
Literally got it wrong, yes. And there's a very famous mistranslation that we'll talk about later. But I sat there and I was just devastated because I was like, everything that I read.
You just spent all this time reading the mistranslated exactly opposite meaning stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's just wrong. Everything is wrong. It wasn't what he said. It wasn't what he intended. And the translator skipped some parts that were difficult to translate. He translated some things incorrectly.
That's so funny.
He omitted some things. He didn't translate some words properly that were very important words, including bell. There was never a bell, Martin.
Wait a minute.
There's never a bell. There's no bell.
And this is something that came out in February of 2023.
No. The mistranslation of bell came out much earlier.
Okay. Then maybe we were like, this is breaking news. Like,
yeah.
There was never a bell.
Yeah, like the banner, the news banner at the bottom of your screen. Breaking news. It wasn't a bell. Everyone, it wasn't a bell. Think of how many psychology textbooks would have to have new graphics. If psychology textbooks cared about accuracy the original.
So when was the bell correction made? Like was that in like the 1940s that got corrected?
So the article that I read that we will talk about still had the word bell in it. And before I read that article, I knew that the bell was a mistranslation. And I have the real Russian word later in my outline. So when we get to that, I'll say what the Russian word is, but I don't want to make up an incorrect Russian word because that has already been done to Pavlov too many times. Well, so it is like another little piece of trivia. Yeah. One piece of trivia is that Pavlov was a physiologist, not a psychologist. Yeah. And another piece of trivia is there was never there was a bell.
No bell.
There were no bells.
If I knew that you could just like skip hard stuff and just like do it wrong, I would do way more translation. Like
absolutely fully.
I could absolutely do that. I could absolutely get the meaning exactly wrong, leave out things that were too hard, and mistranslate the most important word in a text. I can do that.
Absolutely. And think of the world that this translator, the original translator, was working in versus the world today. Like, absolutely unrecognizable. Right. There were no computers. There was no email. There was no Google Translate. There was no, like, voice calling that you could have a face-to-face with someone in Russia across the ocean from you and say, does this make sense to you? Is this a correct translation? So, on one hand, I don't blame him, but on the other hand, like, dude, come on. you can't just skip stuff, right? And the other piece that was very interesting from Olga Yokoyama, the February 2023 article, was that at the time of Pavlov, so contemporary to Pavlov, he was upset that none of his contemporaries were studying his work. He thought that there was this erosion of scholarly study and reading. And he thought at the time in the 18 and 1900s, nobody reads anything anymore. Nobody understands what they're talking about. Nobody actually pays attention to science. Everyone goes around like they're the first person inventing things when all they have to do is read the literature and they would know it's already been done. And he thought that over 100 years ago. And I go around saying this every day, like it's a new concept of nobody reads anymore.
It's just a perennial, like, small scale moral panic. No one reads anymore. Everyone's clothes are silly. The music today is just noise.
The music is just noise. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. But it does reinforce to me that I'm a hundreds of years old, angry scientist man.
Oh, I wonder, he was probably one of the people who stormed out of the Rites of Spring. Like, he totally would have been that kid.
For being too,
He would
too stimulating.
Yeah. He would have been like 11, I think, when that was performed. But he was like, I'm sure he was like an 11-year-old who was like, well, I never...
So getting into the actual study, the actual laboratory, the actual thing that took place, Pavlov was a physiologist and his laboratory observed sham feedings. So feedings where food wasn't actually eaten, didn't actually enter the stomach, because they had an implanted esophageal fistula in dogs.
Oh.
So they were measuring gastric secretions in dogs.
Oh.
They started by measuring the stomach secretions, but they didn't want the food to get in the way of the stomach secretion.
Right.
So they had like a fistula where they introduced the food to the dog's mouth and then removed the food from the body and then measured the stomach secretion.
Right.
And they first observed, as their first little like inkling of something is going on here, that even if the food didn't reach the stomach, they still had an increase in gastric secretions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to measure gastric secretions, so they moved to measuring salivation instead as like a proxy measurement.
Okay.
So they put a small hole into the cheeks of dogs and they implanted basically a little like rain catcher in the hole so that every time the dog salivated, they could precisely measure using graduated cylinders how much the dog salivated.
Oh, okay.
And their first observation, the initial observation that like kicked everything off was, and I'll just read a quote from a poorly translated source, We place before the nose of the dog a glass of carbon bisulfide. From its two salivary glands flows saliva. We stimulate the dog a few times with the same glass of carbon bisulfide. The saliva flows each time. Now we substitute surreptitiously an identical glass containing water. The dog salivates again, although a smaller quantity of saliva. And I looked this up to know what carbon bisulfide or disulfide smells like. And the New Jersey Department of Health says that carbon bisulfide has an eggy, rotten odor. But if it's pure, then it has a sweet odor. So I don't know if it had a sweet odor or an eggy odor. But that's what they were stimulating the dogs with.
Okay.
Pavlov realized that this was significant, and he started exploring the phenomenon. Mm-hmm. He was like a scientist who was curious about things. So he was like, oh, something's going on here. And he first presented these initial results at the International Congress of Medicine held in Spain in 1903. And that was titled Experimental Psychology and Psychopathology in Animals. And one of Pavlov's students gave another lecture contemporary to that, I think it was 1902, where he termed the phenomenon to be psychic secretions.
Oh, wow.
Which I prefer so much.
Yeah.
Pavlov was very wanting to remain as objective as he could, and he re-termed it to be the conditional reflex. So this was a conditional reflex, was the increase of saliva to a glass of just water.
Sure, sure.
Instead of the initial stimulating substance.
Every time you say conditional reflex, I'm going to hear psychic secretion.
I hope so. That's my goal. That's what I want the most in this world, is for people to be thinking about psychic secretion. And I wanted to put a little blip here. Every single person who's ever opened a psychology textbook has seen the diagram of conditioned responses, yes, right? Yep. Do you want to go through the four panels of the psychology textbook dog experiment?
Yeah. Yep. This looks basically like what I remember, except the drawings are a little fancier. It looks like kids today get fancy textbooks with like colors and stuff. All right. So we have four quadrants here in the upper left. The top two are both labeled before conditioning. This is I'm already perplexed by this. This is a badly designed table. In any event, okay. In the upper left, before conditioning, we see an unconditioned stimulus, which is a bowl of kibble, and an unconditioned response, which is a dog, and it is, it looks like saliva falling out of his mouth and his tongue is hanging out. All right. And so next to that, also before condition, we have a neutral stimulus, which is a bell. And it's like the bell that like a church bell choir would use. So it's, you know, it's pitched like F sharp and like, you know, and so that person gets to play like once every 17 measures and they wear white gloves. We don't have the bell choir or the white gloves in this picture, but, and then next to it is a dog with the caption, no response. And the dog.
The dog has no saliva.
There's no saliva, but also seems a little bit annoyed that someone's ringing a bell at its face. So then we have during conditioning, and here we see a picture of that bell ringing. Same note, I'm going to say F sharp, over a bowl of food, same kibble, and the dog is salivating just like before. And then we have a panel that says after conditioning, and we have the bell being rung, no indication that it's a different note. I'm going to say it's still F sharp. And then this is now the conditioned response because it's been paired with the food. And so the dog is now salivating, even when the bell is just being rung. I want you to know that I'm super good at describing figures and tables and charts. And so I'm very happy that you asked me to do that because I'm super good at it. And I think everybody understands what we're looking at here.
I have heard stories of your descriptions and how legendarily effective they are. So exactly like Martin says, this is totally unnecessary given Martin's incredible description. The experiment that everybody knows is that before conditioning, you have an unconditioned stimulus that gives a reflexive response, an automatic response. So the automatic response could be something like the pupil dilating or salivating at the thought of food, or a defense mechanism if you sense that pain is nearby, that sort of thing. Right. So that's an unconditioned response. You don't need any conditioning to that. That's something that is inherent to the experience of being alive. Mm. And then you have a neutral stimulus, one that shouldn't evoke any response necessarily. It's not paired with anything. It doesn't mean anything. It's just a stimulus that occurs out in the world. But if you pair together the unconditioned stimulus or the food and the neutral stimulus that shouldn't give any response, and you do that pairing over and over again a number of times, then eventually you get to the point where the conditioned, the now conditioned stimulus or the ringing of the bell causes the same reaction, the same response as the food. Right. So you have a dog salivating at the sound of a bell instead of at food.
Right.
And that's the story that everybody knows. That's the...
it's classic.
Experiment. Yeah, it's classic. It's classical.
Classical conditioning.
That is classical conditioning. So, the article that introduced Pavlov to the English-speaking world was given by Pavlov in 1906, and it is currently published in Science, and it's titled The Scientific Investigation of the Psychical Faculties or Processes in the Higher Animals. Mm. And this was the Huxley Lecture on Recent Advances in Science and Their Bearing on Medicine and Surgery. And it was given by Pavlov at the Charing Cross Hospital in London on October 1st, 1906.
I think we talked about this last time. I kind of like these bold titles. The Scientific Investigation of the Psychical Faculties or Processes of the Higher Animals. Like, it's so boring that papers now just like describe the interaction between the variables and what the result was, where you just have to read the title and like you understand everything. This is like, this is some deep shit.
It was some deep shit. And Pavlov also dabbled a little bit in comparative anatomy of looking at the brains of different animals.
Cool. Okay.
And understanding how the brain size and makeup and formation related to their abilities as animals.
Right.
And Huxley, do you remember who Huxley is?
I don't.
Huxley is like sort of the reason that we know who Darwin is. He was like Darwin's bulldog, quote unquote, that bullied people into caring about evolution.
Oh, no way.
So it kind of all goes together. Oh, wow. This was like the Huxley lecture given at this hospital for advances that could benefit medicine in the future.
Oh, cool.
And it was given by Pavlov in London. So the other thing that I couldn't tell, I tried to look it up, I don't know, if he gave this lecture in English. I don't know. I don't think he gave it in English. I don't know why this is considered to be his introduction to the English-speaking world, other than he went to London to give this lecture. I don't know if he had a translator there. I don't know any of that. Like, my Google history is just wild. It's just, in 1906, did
he know English?
Yeah. Did he know English? Does he speak English?
Just tell me.
Can Pavlov call me on the phone and I say English to him? Does he know?
Which button can he press on me?
Yeah. Press one. Yeah, all he would have to do in the afterlife is press one button. Press one for English, two for Russian, three for German, four for French, five for Spanish, right? Like, on and on.
Just want to know.
He could press many buttons. He spoke many languages, but did he speak English? I don't fucking know. I don't know. I really tried. I tried my best, but my best was not good enough. But this is our big article, our big presentation, and it was a lecture given at a hospital that English-speaking doctors attended.
Okay.
Cool. So, first line of this article, quote, "For a consistent investigator, there is in the higher animals only one thing to be considered, namely the response of the animal to external impressions. Strictly speaking, natural science is under an obligation to determine only the precise connection which exists between the given natural phenomenon and the responsive faculty of the living organism with respect to this phenomenon. What does this sound like to you?
Precise connection which exists between the given natural... I mean, is this...
It just... sounds like behaviorism.
Oh, okay. Right? So he's just describing... He's arguing something like everything animals do can be understood empirically. We don't need to get in their heads.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
And he sort of like fluctuated back and forth throughout his life of how strictly he followed that or how much he believed that. Like he believed that different dogs that he worked with have different personalities. Okay. He gave them different names, that sort of
right.
thing. But in this lecture, he's saying the only thing that matters is the stimulation that the external world provides.
Right.
And then the responsive faculty in the living organism. So do your salivary glands produce saliva? Do your pupils dilate? Do you have a defense mechanism where you try to move away from something? And how are those related to each other?
He's taking like a psychophysical approach where we are just looking at the things we can measure in the physical world and not trying to impute mental states or anything.
Right. And one of the reasons that he never used a bell in these experiments was that the bell wasn't precise enough. Oh. So he actually used a metronome, because with a metronome, you can get very precise frequencies.
Oh, okay. Right?
And it's very repeatable. But a bell has the variable of how hard someone rings a bell or how long someone rings a bell, that sort of thing. So he was like, this was behaviorism before behaviorism. Yeah. And the more Pavlov I read, the more I'm like, what did John Watson, even add to anything? He didn't do anything. He didn't introduce any new concepts. He didn't have any new ideas. If you're not familiar with Watson, go to season 1, episode 2, where we talk about Watson and make fun of him for a few hours.
I mean, I think the important question is, in terms of handsomeness, how did Pavlov stack up to Watson?
Pavlov is extremely handsome.
Oh, so Watson really brought nothing. Because, I mean, as I understand it, that was one of Watson's main selling points, was he was so handsome.
Is how handsome he was, Yeah, Pavlov was extremely handsome, and he also took 3 months off every year to go do sports.
Okay.
So he was exercising. He was like very physical. He was staying in shape. He was...
It sounds like he had a lot of outside interests. He sounds like a terrific guy.
Yeah, I kind of like him, and I'm worried about saying that, and I don't understand everything about Russia geopolitically in the 18 and 1900s. So I'm like, Pavlov's great. And then it comes out that he like murdered 500 people right?
We also have the kind of traditional relationship with a subordinate thing, which worth worrying about. Generally not terrific.
Yes.
I mean, you know, if you're into that kind of thing, I guess, but
I mean, every old-timey scientist man was 100% into that sort of thing. So maybe we're the weirdos.
Sure.
Raining on their parade.
Yeah, that's right. They, just because they took their power play to work with them. I shouldn't kink shame them.
anyway, the article. So in this article, every experiment that he talks about was performed on dogs. He had a laboratory that was almost exclusively dog studies, except for just a few orphan studies.
Good. I was worried that we didn't have any orphans here.
Right. We've got everything. We've got affairs. We've got orphans. We've got mistranslations. We've got misunderstandings. We've got it all.
Pavlov really did just nail it all right from the beginning.
Just right off the bat. Yeah. He set the standard for everybody. And Pavlov was studying dogs. And the only response that he was looking at in this paper specifically was the physiologically unimportant process, namely the excretion of saliva. Mm. So I'm not calling it unimportant. Right. Probably the excretion of saliva is very important. But he said that they were using that as a sort of like proxy to see if there was a change in the animal's internal state in response to external stimuli. Mm-hmm. So it's known for sure that there's always a flow of saliva in the dog when something is eaten or when anything is put in the dog's mouth. And the saliva varies in quantity and quality very closely in accordance with the nature of the substances in the dog's mm-hmm. mouth. And this is a reflex action. So this isn't something that the dog is deciding. How much saliva should I produce? How much saliva should I put in my mouth?
Right.
What is the thing that is in my mouth? And how much saliva does it right. need? The body just does okay. it naturally.
Okay.
And this is a response of the animal to external influences, and this is accomplished by the aid of the nervous system. Like I said, his PhD thesis was on the nervous system and the heart, so he was very familiar with the nervous system. So the response of the salivary gland is not only governed by this reflexive action, but he noted that it was also stimulated by the eye and the ear. So the presentation of food or the hearing of food. And one of the reports that I read said that Pavlov's phenomenon or conditioning was actually first noticed by the food cart being rolled towards the dogs. So that the dogs would hear the food cart and they'd start salivating at the food cart and not actually at the food. So before this point in time in 1906, it was thought that the responses were psychical, but Pavlov's whole thesis in this article is to restore things to physiology. So it doesn't matter what the psyche is doing. There's a physiological response in the body that is causing these things to happen.
Okay, yeah, cool.
And the rest of the article is extremely straightforward because it was a lecture. Effectively, it's not a study that has graphs, it doesn't have ends, it doesn't have figures, it doesn't have figure legends, that sort of thing. He just goes on to describe in these dogs, in his laboratory dogs, what sort of conditioning he was testing. So even though I said first he was a physiologist, that doesn't mean that he didn't study conditioning. There's been a sort of pendulum where the first wave is everyone thought that Pavlov was a psychologist studying conditioning. And then the second wave is Pavlov didn't study conditioning. He was a physiologist.
Right.
He didn't actually do experiments with conditioning. And the center is that Pavlov, yes, we are centrist here on this podcast. The middle way, the center way, is that Pavlov was a physiologist who studied conditioning as a phenomenon within physiology. So he did many, many experiments over years, over decades. He did many conditioning experiments, but the conditioning experiments were from a physiological basis rather than a psychological basis. So the rest of the paper is him describing like the different stimuluses they used, the different pairings that they did. He described the timing, so the gap between the unconditioned stimulus, for example, the bell, or what he actually used was a metronome. He used shocks. He used like bitter tastes, that sort of thing. So he did a whole variety of different unconditioned stimulus. He varied the timing of the conditioned and the unconditioned stimulus. He varied the mode. Right? So he had some auditory stimulus, some oral stimulus, taste stimulus, some visual stimulus. And he did all of these tests to see what was the strongest pairing, right? What was most likely to lead to a result. And he found that if he conditioned the dogs to a chord of three notes, that if he only played two notes, they only salivated a little bit. And if he only played one note, they didn't salivate if they were conditioned to the full
chord,
the full three notes. He also did scratching on the dog, and he found that if he scratched in the same spot versus a different spot, he got different responses. He did temperature stimulation of hot versus cold. He did optical stimulation. So he did a ton of studies. He just never used a bell. So every single diagram in every psychology textbook is factually incorrect. And there were so many options that they had to pick from, and they didn't pick a single one of them.
And that was corrected early on, you said.
That was before the 2023. I don't know what year it was, like, international news. There was no bell. But that was known much, much before modern psychology textbooks were printed. Yeah. And so his lecture, we're kind of already through it, but it was basically, I have noticed this phenomenon. I am rigorously studying this phenomenon. We are going to continue studying this phenomenon. So he ends his lecture with three takeaways or three questions. And the first is that this is an incredible area. It's a wide open field to be explored. Uh-huh. The studies can be repeated. They can be subdivided. They can be studied extensively. He was saying like, hey, everyone should be studying this. This is huge. This is a huge thing that I've come across. The second point is that it requires objective opinions only. So there is nothing subjective. Right. There is no introspection. There's no Freud. Right. This is an exact measurement of the output, which is saliva. And Freud was earlier. So Freud was before Pavlov. Yes. So all of psychology at the time was that introspective psychology where your psyche is very deep and complex and things can't really be understood without extensive introspective work. And Pavlov was like, nah, just measure the saliva. So there's a bunch of people at the time. I'm sure that as introspection was all the rage, I think every time I talk about introspection, I say everybody was thinking this. But obviously, when you have something very popular, you have people who are reacting to that popular thing and in the other direction. So there were always people who were anti-introspection, anti-Freud, anti that level of psychology. Right. But they were just less. I guess now I'm wondering, like, were they actually less popular or were they positioning themselves as the underdogs? Who knows? We'll never know. There'll be people who have written about it, but they wrote in German and you can't trust. You can't trust translations because they're wrong. Wait, but you speak 1800s academic German, Martin.
I really discount my ability to do that.
Well, it doesn't matter because the leading translator for Pavlov just did whatever. You can just say whatever.
Yeah, this episode is really making me reconsider my skill level in translating 19th century academic German. Because
I hope the main takeaway from this episode for everybody is it doesn't matter. Just
everyone can be a translator.
Just do what you want to do. It doesn't matter. You'll be the best at it. You're the best one. You just have to get one other person to say you're the best one, and then you will be the best one. We are now a Tony Robinson podcast.
Oh, good. Season 2, sponsored by...
Robbins?
I think it's Tony Robbins, The guy with the teeth, right?
Well, we should... I don't know, but we should look his name up.
It's Tony Robbins, the motivational speaker with, like, the glowing white teeth. Yeah. This is a big upgrade, because last season we were...
Does he not produce saliva if his teeth are so white?
We would have to ask Pavlov. I am not a saliva scholar or a swallowologist.
Okay, so the 3 points. Number one was a lot of this can be studied. This is a wide open field. Number two, it's very objective, and you have to be objective. And number three... there's an unusual abundance of questions. Which department of physiology does it correspond to?
Oh, okay.
Is it the sensory organs? Is it the nervous system? Is it the tissue itself? Like, where is this happening? How is it happening? Yeah. And he says that previously physiology was viewed through psychology. And quote, hitherto this department of physiology has been throughout most of its extent availed itself of ideas not its own, ideas borrowed from psychology, but now there is a possibility of its being liberated from such evil influences. So liberated from evil influences. The first time I read that, I was like, go Pavlov, calling psychology evil. And now I'm like, it was just a mistranslation. It was just a shitty translation. Yeah. Is he calling psychology evil or did his translator call psychology evil? I don't know. I have no way of knowing.
His translator was just doing one of those like memes where you stick weird words under a picture of like Lincoln and just like, you know, Popeye's chicken sandwich is the best. Abraham Lincoln. Like,
oh my God.
He was just doing that.
Yeah, he was having a good day. He was walking around just doing whatever. Who knows what that meme was up to. So Pavlov finishes this quote to a bunch of medical doctors by basically saying, if we understand the body, then we can heal the body. So he's saying the more we understand about this, the more we understand basic science, the more we understand about physiology, then people who have malformations or defects or errors in their physiological functions can be healed. It is an extreme satisfaction to me that in honoring the memory of a great physiologist and man of science, I'm able to make use of ideas and facts, which from a unique standpoint affording every prospect of success throw light upon the highest and most complicated portion of the animal mechanism. And I believe he's saying that he was inspired by Ivan Mikhailovich Sechenov, and he was a Russian scientist who advocated for objective psychology and physiology.
Cool.
So that was his lecture in 1906 in London. And his laboratory functioned for decades. This is where we get into the geopolitical stuff, because he won the Nobel Prize in 1904. And then there was the full revolution and overthrow of the government in Russia. That was a pretty big deal. That was 1916. Yep.
16 and 17, yeah.
Yeah. So Pavlov was internationally renowned. He was a Russian treasure. He was a Nobel laureate. And he had a functioning laboratory before the revolution. And then the revolution happened. And he still had a functioning laboratory after the revolution. But he had his funding severely cut. He was almost starving. He relied on his like international collaborators for food and for funding for the laboratory and that sort of thing, but he maintained the laboratory and he was able to keep it open and able to have scientists working through the end of his life, which was in the 1930s, 1936. So it was this huge upheaval, this huge transition, but he still was doing science at the time. And he wrote letters to Molotov, the guy that was way up in the Russian cabinet, and complained about how he was being treated. And he got some special treatment because he had won the Nobel Prize. I believe he had to turn over his Nobel laureate money.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he was upset about that because it was considered property of the state. And like on and on and on. You could go the whole down that whole rabbit hole of doing science during a revolution.
Yeah, it's going to be rough.
Very rough. But 10 years after the revolution, in 1926, a film was released about his work, and this film is available on YouTube. And it was made with him and his students, and he saw the film, and he, I believe, gave like lectures over the film as the film was playing, because it had those cards, like silent movie style. The
intertitles.
Yeah, exactly. And the title of the film is Mechanics of the Brain.
Wow.
I can't pronounce the Russian title. I don't speak Russian. It's my downfall.
You could just translate it, though. I mean, I don't know. Like, you can just do that.
I have translated this title. It's called Pavlov Stuff. It's a good movie. It's on YouTube. You should watch it. But it's about 45 minutes long. And it was originally in Russian. And then my understanding is that it was shipped to Detroit, and an English translation was made in Detroit. And then the original movie, the physical original movie, was destroyed because it was on a material that was so flammable it might explode at any time.
Yeah. That was a real thing for early films was, the medium itself was highly combustible. This was a constant problem for old film stock.
So we're very lucky that a copy was made in Detroit and we have the YouTube version. But it shows frog experiments, it shows dog experiments, monkey experiments, and then finally we get to our human experiment. So I was not able to determine if this was before Watson. So Watson's paper was published in 1920, where he did the Little Albert study. And the Little Albert study was looking at if fear could be conditioned into a tiny, adorable baby, one-year-old baby. This film came out in 1926, and the film included some of the work by one of Pavlov's students named Nikolai Krasnogorsky. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to find that much on the internet about Nikolai Krasnogorsky, except for a whole bunch of sensationalist websites saying, look at this evil stuff that Pavlov did in his laboratory, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So the same fistula that was implanted in dogs where there was a small hole made in the cheek and then like a cylinder to catch saliva was implanted into children. Some of the websites said they were orphans. Some just said children. I don't know if they were orphans. They might have been orphans.
I mean, in Russia around that time, there would have been a lot. Russia didn't do so great in World War One, and then they had, a decade of civil war? So there were a lot of orphans.
There certainly were orphans.
Yeah.
I don't know if these were orphans. They probably were orphans. They might have been orphans. Right. I don't know. I have no information one
Regardless,
way or the
other. Seems pretty horrific. But,
yeah, they were collecting saliva, right? The film didn't say, we then patched up their cheeks and gave them food and sent them on their way. And they didn't say, we then just left them with this fistula in their cheek forever. I don't know what happened to the children after this, but the movie shows very specifically an experimental setup where there's two experiments with children. One has the fistula where they're showing the children food and then they begin to salivate. And then the second is a bit more silly, where they have an apparatus, like a strap around their whole head. And then they also have pressure, a pressure cuff on their wrist. And every time they're presented with a cookie, the pressure cuff activates on their wrist and effectively squeezes their wrist. And then they're measuring, does the child open their mouth to receive a cookie? And every time a cookie is presented, the child opens her mouth. And when the cookie is presented, it's paired with the wrist squeeze. Okay. So eventually they just squeeze the wrist and then the child opens their mouth. And that's the experiment. So that one's not invasive. It's giving children cookies. Right.
Yeah, that, I like that one a little more. Maybe they could have just done that.
But how would you measure this life?
I mean, it seems like you've demonstrated your reflex point here. But yeah, I guess I guess Pavlov is obsessed with saliva. So
obsessed with saliva. It's so objective. Saliva is the most objective output that we have.
If there's something more objective than saliva, Pavlov's never heard of it.
Saliva wasn't lied to you. Saliva doesn't go to church. Saliva doesn't care if you're cheating on your wife, right? Saliva just is there, and it gets produced, and then it's just there.
I see his point now. Yeah. No, I'm totally turned around. I'm totally okay with, I'm not going to say it. He should have just given children cookies and squeezed their wrists.
Just give the children cookies,
squeeze their wrists.
Right.
That seems way better. Come on, buddy.
Right. And with the whole translation thing with Marie Antoinette saying, let them eat cake, but it's not actually cake, right? It's a sweetbread. I'm like, were they actually giving these children cookies, or what were they giving these children?
Yeah, what on earth was it?
Was it a cookie? Was it a chocolate chip cookie? What was it?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Was it a protein bar?
Again, things weren't great in the early Soviet Union here. There probably wasn't a lot of money for cookies at this point.
So in this experiment, they paired the wrist pressure with the cookie, and then eventually they did only the wrist pressure and not the cookie, and the child would open their mouth still to receive a cookie, even if there was no cookie. But as part of extinction testing, or seeing if this would go away, they kept doing only the wrist squeeze. And eventually the child would stop opening their mouth to receive a cookie. And in the film, you see the child sort of glaring in the direction of where the experimenter is standing. Because he's like, where the fuck is my cookie? Why am I not getting a cookie?
He's not wrong.
Yeah. Give a cookie. Yeah.
It would be interesting to know if this was before or after Watson, because this is one of the things that Watson also claimed, this was the study that Watson claimed they didn't have time to test, right? The extinction
was extinction. Right.
Even though they did witness extinction and just had to, quote, refresh the stimulus. Watson was so bad.
And I know Watson was so bad. I know that Watson was a bad researcher and a bad person because he didn't read the literature, because Pavlov talked specifically about auditory sounds and violent sounds and how those weren't as effective for conditioning as other kinds of sounds. And if you remember Watson's study, Watson had that huge clanging bar to be very fearful as the conditioning, right? So I'm like, Watson was bad. He was a bad person. He didn't read anything. He didn't know anything. He claimed everything for himself. I went back and looked at Watson's paper again, and he never said Pavlov's name.
Right.
His paper. And he only had two citations in his paper, and they were both to his own work. How arrogant, how self-absorbed can you be?
He wasn't even good at unethical research.
Mm-hmm. So Watson sucked. Pavlov did mostly dog experiments, but also monkey experiments, also child experiments with cookies. And yeah, that's like the very brief overview of Pavlov. And as I was reading everything, I had two questions. And my first question was the bell real? Was it a mistranslation? Was it uncritically repeated through the textbook industry? Was it a misunderstanding? And then my second question that I had was Pavlov truly the first to talk about conditioned or conditional responses? Right. So for question number one, the bell, was the bell real? Absolutely not. The bell is not real.
Wow.
It was a mistranslation of the Russian word zvonik, which should be translated to buzzer, but it got mistranslated to bell. And there was one researcher named Daniel P. Toedes who gained access to the absolutely massive Pavlov archives in Russia. And he went back to Russia and he read like everything. Right. And he wrote, I believe it's almost 900 pages. He wrote a 900 page biography of Pavlov. And he said that for Pavlov, a bell wasn't a suitable experimental protocol because it couldn't be precisely controlled. He used a metronome, a harmonium, a buzzer, and an electrical shock device.
Okay. Huh.
So, no, the bell is not real. The bell was a zvonik. And zvonik should be translated to buzzer, not bell. And then the second question was Pavlov first? Was he the first person to write about conditioned responses? And I found a rather silly article. And the article was talking about in literature, so not scientific literature, but like literature as a whole, has there ever been described conditioned responses? And this article is titled Pavlov's Reflex Before Pavlov, Early Accounts from the English, French, and German Classic Literature. And the first one was from François Rabelais. Rabelais. And this was from right about 1500. Yeah. And he wrote The Very Horrific Life of Great Gargantua, Father of Pantagruel.
Have you read that?
I wish. I just did 100 days of French in Duolingo, so I'll check this book out.
You can read it in English. I read it in English.
You really? Yeah. How come at the very top of this episode you didn't say, Christina, why are we even talking about Pavlov? We should be talking about The Very Horrific Life of Great Gargantua, Father of Pantagruel. So off the top of your head, do you remember the conditioning that happened?
I don't remember conditioning happening in this story, actually. I don't remember. Or, I mean, maybe I do, but I certainly didn't think of it as conditioning.
Yeah. As conditioning? So the authors of this other article stated that the baby in the story when he was 22 months old, he was so accustomed to drinking wine in the morning that the sound of pints and flagons would devolve him into an ecstasy, as if he had tasted the joys of paradise. Sure. So in the morning, to cheer this giant baby up, they played with a knife on glasses, on bottles, on pottle pots with their lids and covers, and the baby leapt for joy, would loll and rock himself in the cradle and nod his head, monochordizing with his fingers and baritonizing with his stern. So he was so happy from drinking wine that even the sound associated with drinking wine made him extremely, extremely happy.
Oh, cool.
And that was the first instance of conditioning
being discussed
in the literature.
Oh, very cool.
So what happens to Great Gargantua?
The entire story is very odd.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's about a giant baby who loves wine. I mean, it became really popular in the 90s when Mikhail Bakhtin's analyses got translated. And so Bakhtin had this critical theory of the carnivalesque. And so and he used Rabelais as an example of this. And it's all about things being weird and shifting the rules of society and offering these moments of transgression that can sometimes be the engine for reformation, but other times just be a release valve that allows society to continue as it is. So I don't know. Yeah. I happened to go to grad school at the time when talking about Rabelais was cool. So that's my, that's the only reason I know anything about it.
Did you ever write a song about how happy wine makes babies?
I mean,
happy babies drinking wine. Ecstatic, absolutely ecstatic babies.
Just hearing about wine and going nuts.
So that was the literature side. So then the very serious question is, was Pavlov the first in the scientific literature side? Was he the first person to actually describe classical conditioning, Pavlovian conditioning in humans or at all? And the answer is
no. Okay.
Maybe not. But it becomes again a question of like translation what literature was available to what people at what time. Because there wasn't the internet. You couldn't just go on the internet and Google conditioning. Has anyone done it? Question mark. So it sort of developed in parallel in Russia and in America at the same time. And the American that nobody talks about is named Edwin B. Twitmeyer. And he was at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was studying the knee-jerk reflex.
But like, we know why no one talks about Edwin B. Twitmeyer, right?
Don't even make fun of his name. He has a beautiful name. I will not have anyone making fun of Twitmeyer. I wish my name was Twitmeyer. Are you kidding me? To be able to have the power to look people in the face and say, my name is Twitmeyer, and then you just like dare them to make fun of you.
Dr. Christina B. Twitmeyer.
Dr. Twitmeyer. Hello, my name is Dr. Twitmeyer, and I can fail you in this class.
There's nothing actually stopping you from doing that, you know.
Okay, I'll do it tomorrow.
This is where our voluminous Patreon earnings will go. They'll go to you funding a legal name change.
I've heard they're very expensive, so please join us on Patreon to fund my name change to Dr. Christina Edwin B. D. Twitmeyer. Beautiful. So he was at the University of Pennsylvania and he was studying the knee jerk reflex. And the knee jerk reflex, in case you were born under a rock and your knees have never moved around, is when you tap the patellar tendon with a hammer, the leg involuntarily moves, it kicks out. Mm-hmm. So Twitmeyer had asked his subjects to verbalize the word ah, or clench their fists under facilitating conditions. So he had normal conditions where he just hit people's knee with a hammer. And then he had these facilitating conditions where he asked them to perform more to compare, is the reflex the same under the facilitated condition as compared to the normal condition? He also primed them with a bell.
This time it actually was a bell?
He said a bell. In English. I don't know if he like did a back and forth translation where he said bell, it got translated to buzzer, buzzer was translated to bell, that sort of thing. So he rang a bell half a second before tapping the tendon. And then in one subject, the single bell was rung. And then the subject kicked both of his legs after only the bell and none of the tapping stimulation. So that was like, whoa, sir, why are you kicking your legs at me? I didn't even tap your patellar tendon. So then he was very curious about this and he went on to study this. And he thought that the two options were either that the subject had voluntarily moved his legs, the subject was just kicking his legs because he wanted to, or that the knee jerk had been produced by a stimulus other than the tapping stimulus. So the sound stimulus actually produced the kicking as compared to the tapping. So Twitmeyer did more studies of this and he found 100% of his six subjects had the same response, where eventually after 150 to 238 pairings of the bell and the tap, you could elicit the reflex with only the bell. So everyone can go home and tap their patellar tendon and ring a bell at the same time, and eventually you'll have a superpower where you can activate your reflex with only the bell and without tapping.
After only 150 to 238 pairings.
It sounds like a really good party, right? Like you invite all your friends over and everyone just tries to see how quickly you can get this reflex. How many pairings?
As we said before, it seems like it was way easier to do science back then. Like, you actually could do this exact study at a party because they only had six subjects. And
only
these
six.
Are some big-ass error bars. Like, that's 150 to 238?
Well, the cool thing you could do at the party would be see which pairing, which unconditioned stimulus, a neutral stimulus, right? Like, which neutral stimulus will give the fastest
pairing.
The fastest conditioning.
Yeah. So everyone out there, go do some classical conditioning parties. I hear that's what the kids are into these days.
I wish. If you do one, please invite me and I will go. That sounds so fun. Oh my God. The six subjects said that their responses were not voluntary. So they were reflexive and they couldn't be voluntarily inhibited. So even if they were trying to prevent the kicking from happening, it still happened. And Twitmeyer published this in a paper titled Knee Jerks Without Stimulation of the Patellar Tendon, Twitmeyer 1905. And this was at the 13th meeting of the APA, the American Psychological Association, in 1904 in Philadelphia. There was another guy at that meeting, William James, who is the president of the APA, and he also studied the patellar reflex. But according to this paper I read, after Twitmeyer gave his presentation, it was like absolute silence. Nobody cared. The president didn't care. Nobody cared. And there was a little footnote by Kuhn, 1982. And Twitmeyer said that the reason nobody cared was, quote, due to William James's becoming bored or hungry at noontime and adjourning the meeting without allowing for a discussion of the paper. So the president wanted a sandwich. He was like, who cares? Is this the first description of classical conditioning in America? Absolutely. Do I care? Not even one little bit. Let's go get lunch. Let's have cigars and vodka and eat lunch.
This is old-timey APA sounds amazing.
It sounds wonderful.
It's just papers get swept under the rug because someone's hangry, or Harry Harlow stands up and flirts with everyone, or
So I've thought about this. I go to the Society for Neuroscience every single year, and you have these poster blocks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the very worst poster block is obviously the very last block of the very last day. And I have wondered forever how the course of history and neuroscience has been changed based on who got shuttled to the last poster block where nobody's there to look at their poster. God. And everyone has already left for the airport.
Yeah.
Like, how different would the timeline be with a different setup?
Right. These last day studies. There's almost certainly a way to, like, find listings for the last poster session every year going back as, you know, as long as APA or whatever, whatever organization has records. And there's something there.
Can we get big AI?
I think so. This is a big data. This is a big data experiment waiting to be done.
I think we've said too many mean things for anyone from big data to want to do the study now. But like, let's just ask. So as the very last thing, I compiled a list from Daniel P. Todds, the researcher that went and read all of Pavlov's archive. He did basically a BuzzFeed list of like top 25 things you didn't know about Pavlov. So I just pulled the interesting ones out, and we'll end with a nice BuzzFeed top 5 things you didn't know about Pavlov.
All right.
Number 5, he more than doubled the budget for his lab by bottling gastric juice he withdrew from the dogs that were his subjects. And he sold it, and apparently Russian people and French and German people just loved to treat ailments with dog gastric juice.
Like what kind of ailments?
Whatever you want. Anything can be fixed by dog gastric juice.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Sure. Number 4. Pavlov took 3 months off every year, and he went and lived at his summer home. And he went and he exercised, and he played a sport called Grodki, which is a Russian sport where the players throw heavy wooden bats at formations of other heavy bats. So it sounds like a fun game, and Pavlov was very good at throwing bats at other bats.
Okay, good. He spent 3 months every year doing it, so I bet he was good.
He's very good.
Cool. I would love 3 months off to just throw bats at bats. Instead, I take 3 months off every summer to prepare for the next year and try to publish some stuff I can keep my job.
Have you considered throwing bats at other bats?
I'm going to see if I can get that counted toward tenure. I'll talk to my TNP committee, see if throwing bats at bats is like, is there a slot for that?
Yeah, is there a line? Is there a place?
Can I get that in my role statement?
Number 3, Pavlov's closest scientific collaborator for 20 years of his life, Maria Petrova, was also his lover. She wasn't his student.
Oh, okay. Right? Yeah, when you say closest scientific collaborator, that does sound better. I guess I just, based on like history, assumed that it was a subordinate of his.
I mean, she was a subordinate. Oh, okay. He was the head of the laboratory.
Oh, sure, sure. And okay.
And this is a patriarchal society.
Right. So really not great.
On and on and on.
Really not great, but at least not a student, I guess. We give him like half a point for that.
Half a point, not a student.
Great, buddy.
Number 2. During a trip to the United States in 1923, he was mugged and robbed of all his money at Grand Central Station, and he wanted to go home where it was safe, but was convinced to stay and have a great visit. So 100 years ago, Pavlov was robbed in Grand Central Station.
He was thinking, I want to go back to Russia, which is...
I want to go back to Russia.
Or the USSR, I suppose, which is in the middle of a civil war because it's safe there. It's
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Number one, fun fact about Pavlov. When the communist state sent a political militant to purge his lab of political undesirables, Pavlov literally kicked him down the stairs and out of the building.
Wow.
So all of his time spent playing Gorodki and throwing bats at other bats helped protect the science.
Nice.
And he sent the stooge a packet.
Yeah, okay. I like that. Academic freedom.
Academic freedom. All right, that's it. That's what we got for Pavlov.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty exciting. That was very different than I was expecting.
So, pop quiz. Was there a bell?
There was no bell.
There was no bell.
Oh, no. What did we do?
That's horrible.
Did you set me up for that?
No, I didn't. I wouldn't want that to happen. I don't want that to happen. Did you do that on purpose?
I didn't. Should we edit that out? I'll cover it up with a bell.
Do you know what time it is now?
Are
you conditioned to know what time it is now?
What audio cue would let me know what time it is?
I don't know. Should we take a listen?
Right. Let's take a listen.
It's time for the definitely legitimate, absolutely real-life legitimate pop culture reference of the day.
I could tell because after the song played, I was salivating. Saliva doesn't lie.
Saliva doesn't lie. It always tells the truth. So in my realm of references, I have three references, and one of them is episodes of Frasier because I've seen every episode of Frasier a minimum of 5 times, right?
How do you feel about the return of Frasier?
I have not watched a single episode of the return of Frasier.
Okay. You don't have any strong opinions about it? You're not a purist who thinks that...
I am a purist, absolutely. Okay. I'm in Frasier shitposting groups on the internet.
All right, yeah.
And they all hate Frasier. So all my homies hate the new Frasier. Therefore, I hate the new Frasier.
Okay.
And it doesn't have Niles in it. I'm actually a Niles purist. Right, I'm not a Frasier purist. I'm a Niles purist.
I don't know if you told me that before or if I just could sense it.
I definitely told you that before. But also, I feel like I reek of Niles energy.
Yeah, you get strong Niles vibes. Yeah.
Strong Niles vibes. Any reboot that had Niles in it, I would definitely watch, but it doesn't, so But in Frasier, there's one episode where Bulldog is playing pranks on Frasier, and Bulldog is like the football guy at the radio station. Right. So he's doing like cool pranks on Frasier, and Frasier goes to talk to his dad and Niles, I think, and he says, "I've designed the perfect prank to get Bulldog back." Mm-hmm. Every time Bulldog's favorite team loses, Bulldog's favorite football team loses, I'm going to tie a red balloon to his car, and soon the sight of a red balloon will drive him mad.
I think I remember this.
Yeah, because it's wonderful. It's wonderful. But if Frasier actually read Pavlov, he would know that the timing of the conditioned and neutral stimulus matter.
Right.
So having the red balloon show up well after the football game or be discovered well after the football game probably wouldn't be very effective.
It'd be pretty weak conditioning.
Weak conditioning, You'd have to repeat it maybe 238 times.
Right. Up to 238.
Up to 238 times.
Yeah. Several seasons. That would be a pretty cool prank, actually, if it did work, because it would have meant that Frasier had committed about 30 years to it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's a commitment that I think is really admirable about a prank that takes 30 years to pull off.
If in the new Frasier, they say Frasier is actively doing this prank from season 5, episode 2, or whatever, then I would start watching Frasier.
I would love it if the show was just was a real-time recapitulation of that study, so that we see each of the 238 losses and Frasier, like that day. So we have 238 episodes, each of which is a day that Bulldog's favorite team loses. What I really want out of my sitcoms is experimental rigor.
Right. That's also what I am looking for. Absolutely. Yeah.
We should make a sitcom that's just about experimental rigor.
It's our party where we do patellar stimulation for 236 combinations. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We can film that and call it a sitcom.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. They had pretend nerds doing dumb shit and called it, what was that show with the nerds who were physicists that was the most popular show in the universe?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
What was it called? We'll edit this so it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. Big Bang Theory.
Oh, I never watched the
Big Bang Theory. Yeah, neither did I. No one watched it. Or a lot of people watched it, but it was terrible. it was people pretending to be nerds doing dumb nerd shit. But they didn't do it rigorously.
Did they do patellar?
No. Delicious. Not as far as I know. There were like 900 episodes, so maybe they did it at one point.
I hope
but
so.
But yeah, okay. Well, we can do it right. That would be the pitch. It's like Big Bang Theory, but with more rigor. And I think every network will say,
here's a lot of money. As a backup, absolutely legitimate pop culture reference of the day, I was thinking the conditioning sequence in Zoolander, where where he's conditioned to kill the prime minister of Malaysia.
Yeah.
When Frankie says, relax. Is played. How do you feel about that? I kind of went back and forth. I was like, does this work? Does this not work? Is it classical? Is it not?
I was going to say, that wouldn't be classical though, would it? Because killing the prime minister of Malaysia isn't like an inborn response, right? Like that.
I don't know. What does saliva have to say about killing the prime minister of Malaysia?
Yeah. I'm beginning to see the wisdom of saliva.
So that's it. What do you think? What did you learn?
I learned a lot. I said at the beginning, like, I felt like I had a really solid handle on this one just because of how foundational it is. And I guess kind of I did. But yeah, there was a lot that I still had wrong. And this time, this time it seemed less like my fault. Because even if I... Because it was literally mistranslated. Like someone tried to deceive me on this one. I couldn't have gotten most of this right, even if I had read the original article, because, you know, unless I read it in the Russian, I still would have been wrong. So,
right. And the translation that I read still used the word bell.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
So after I was reading the 2023 article about translating Pavlov, I went back and I reread the article that I presented, his speech in London. Yeah. And I was like, what of this can I trust? Yeah. Can I trust my own eyes? Can I trust my ears? Can I trust that I'm in the correct universe? Right. So I think, you know how Trump said we need to test less so that we have fewer cases of coronavirus?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think the real takeaway is that we should all read less.
Yeah.
And then we won't read incorrect things that are wrong.
I can't argue with that, actually. If my students presented that to me as an argument for why they didn't do the reading, I would have no choice but to just like go along with it. That's a hack right there.
Yeah, first prove to me that this article was not mistranslated, and then I will read it.
Yeah, fair enough. Also, that's part of why I'm happy I didn't read that article and don't read most of these articles. I make you do it for me.
Because they're wrong. Yeah. And I just show up and I say, Martin, guess what? It's all wrong. Everything's wrong.
Yeah, that's a good plan. I think you should just keep reading articles.
Well, I was wondering if next time, season two, episode two, do you want to read an article about how much you interrupt me?
Yeah, okay.
Do you want to read an article about what portion of the time I talk versus what portion of the time that you talk? Do you want to read that?
I guess I kind of do, but then I'm also a little bit scared that I'm going to go back and look at the... I have the audio files. I can do the calculation. And it's probably going to turn out that I'm talking like 75% of the time, even though you're the one literally reading the article to me. I would not be even the slightest bit surprised.
Well, is there any literature that you know of that talks about the proportion that men versus women talk? Is there anyone who's worked on that?
There are a lot, in fact.
Is there anyone Australian who's worked on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of work on this, but we're going to look at the work of Dale Spender, who is one of the early researchers into this phenomenon, or the various phenomena of perceptions of communication across genders. So, yeah, that's our plan for next time.
I'm so excited to be very heightened and aware of how much I interrupt you versus how much you interrupt me. I'm so excited.
Yeah, this could only lead to a more productive working relationship.
I'm going to keep a little buzzer. We should each have a buzzer, right? And every time someone interrupts, we press the buzzer and then we look at the number of buzzer presses at the end of the article. Or of the podcast, and we also measure how much saliva we have each output.
Perfect.
And I think those two data points will make a beautiful graph that we can put on the Patreon. Can we make a graph? I want to make a graph.
Let's make graphs.
Join us next week where Martin explains patriarchal society.
Hey, Christina makes graphs.
And I make graphs. Oh, yeah. Outro.